Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cobbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today we are going to talk about the company of angels. Angels are very interesting creatures. They are what we would kind of like describe as cherubs today. We see them everywhere, specifically around Valentine. But their history is so much more and so much more intriguing than that. And we hope that in our first visit to angelology today, we are going to go a tiny bit deeper into angels. Now, Kathleen, you have just done The Poet Prince, which is a month old now.
Yeah.
And one of the people who passes through there, somewhat briefly, but kind of like making definitely an impact, is a person called Michelangelo.
Yes, he does. I want to back up for just a second and simply say that for so many years, we went through a big angel craze. We certainly did in America. I don't know if the same thing happened around the world, but in the 80s especially, sort of at the in the fledgling days of the New Age boom, there was a lot of angelic literature, a lot of books about angels, and some of them were very lovely, but for me, I was never really much of an angel person. I always kind of felt that it was sort of light and fluffy and very sweet and lovely, and you know, if you wanted to invoke your angels or pray to angels or if angels made you happy, you know, God bless you, that's a great thing. But it just never really felt like much to me. I was not raised in a religious environment where angels were invoked. So I always thought that they were just sort of pretty things that I hung on my Christmas tree, you know, Hark the Herald Angels Sing and all that stuff. But I never had any real personal connection to this idea of angels and angelic intervention and all of that, or guardian angels. I mean, I think I've always leaned toward the, yes, there are spirit guides. Yes, we all have, you know, help from the other side when we need it. But I think I've always looked at it more as an ancestral thing than maybe an angelic thing necessarily. However, all of this really changed for me over the last couple of years when I got deeply involved in my Renaissance research. For those who are new to me or my work or this show, my new book, The Poet Prince, is the third novel in my series, and this particular book is about the birth of the Renaissance, very much about the de' Medici family, specifically Lorenzo de' Medici, who is the poet prince who nurtures the Renaissance and brings it to life. In the most beautiful and golden way possible by becoming the shepherd for these extraordinary artists who paint angels everywhere. And I think that, you know, we all see these iconic angels, the Raphael angels, for example. You see them on everything. They're on, you know, coffee mugs and cartoon characters. And I think that we just overall tend to kind of write them off as being either cute or pretty, but not necessarily important. And what I have learned in my Renaissance studies is they are dramatically important. Not just my opinion, but certainly the people who were painting them saw them as extraordinary forces of intervention of God's will on earth. And so that's one of the things I really want to talk about today. I want to talk about this idea of angelic invocation. These people were invoking angelic forces. The Renaissance was all about understanding the power of the contact between angels and humans. So I definitely want to go into that. But you, in your own research, have also encountered some very, very powerful angelic forces and angelic societies.
Yes, absolutely. And I think when you look at the New Testament, you see angels as these messengers of God. It's kind of like the postal service. They deliver a message from God to us in a beautiful apparition, which says everybody kind of goes, wow, that's beautiful. But I learned that there was really a different dimension to angels, specifically when I was confronted with what would be the kind of background mystery to the Priory of Zion, and specifically Saint-Sulpice. There's a lot of information about Saint-Sulpice which really has never made it into the English language, and specifically all of that information has to do with an angelic society. And the angelic society in France is said to have been created in the 16th century around a book called the Hypnoteramachia Polyphili, which was written in Italy at roughly around 1500. And it's a passion which Kathleen and I share, and which we'll definitely come back to later on in an episode. But basically, this very enigmatic, very beautiful book It exists around 1500 in Italy, and when it becomes available in French and in France in Lyon about 40 years later, the people who are studying this are known as the Angelic Society. And then over the century, specifically in the 19th century, it is said that the headquarters of this Angelic Society had moved from Lyon to Paris, and specifically the Chapel of the Angels in Saint-Sulpice. Now, the Chapel of the Angels in Saint-Sulpice is, when you come in, the first thing on your right, before you go to the Gnomon, which is on the other side. And the Chapel of Saint-Sulpice in the 1860s was painted by a painter called Eugène Delacroix. And he painted three beautiful paintings. One of them is Jacob, who is struggling with his guardian angel. And this is the story about Jacob, which is an Old Testament story, whereby Jacob has slain his brother. And basically what he's trying to get from God is saying, I kind of know I killed him, but it wasn't my fault, and I can do this because I'm going to play and have a contest with my angel. And Jacob and his angel have this extraordinary match whereby Jacob keeps praying for forgiveness, and his angel kind of thinks, like, this isn't happening. And the angel even hurts his thigh, Jacob's thigh, and thinking, like, well, you know, if I hurt his thigh, he will be in pain, and he'll stop praying to me. Because the story is that as long as you pray to your angel or an angel, the angel is forced to listen to what you do. Not necessarily forced to grant what you do, because that's kind of like that judgment there, but forced to listen. And in the end, his angel realizes that this guy isn't going anywhere, and the angel says, okay. The other one is Heliodorus being chased from the temple. And their angels basically intervene when somebody has come to steal the treasure of the Temple of Solomon. However, high above is Michael, Saint Michael, who is controlling the dragon, the beast, at his feet. And this is, of course, one of the icons, because Michael is the one, and this is, I think, like the core story which people have forgotten, and which was so omnipresent a few centuries ago. The story of Michael goes back to that very important thing, the very important dude, Lucifer. Lucifer is at the right hand of God until he rebels and says, like, I'm not following any more orders, this is all about free will to me. And he strikes a deal with God and says, I want to leave, I want to do this. And God says, okay. And then God finds out that it's not just Lucifer, but various people have left. Heaven and all the angels basically are empty offices. And God puts a stop to this, and amongst those who are left behind, Michael is placed on the seat, the right-hand seat of God, formerly occupied by Lucifer. And that is basically the depiction which you see of, like, Michael being put in charge of this chaos created. And it's a very iconographic, very symbolic picture, which goes back to ancient Egypt. You see the depictions of order and chaos and balance, which the deities of, like, Isis, Osiris, Mart, and all of these. It's a very traditional, a very powerful subject. And Delacroix has painted all of these three themes about angels in the Chapel of Angels. And very much different than the little cherubs who are kind of like, you know, splashing about. And from that, basically the message is that the Angelic Society, as I think I said before on a previous broadcast of the Spirit Revolution, this wasn't about little cherubs. The Angelic Society were very important people who had a vast esoteric knowledge, who lived roughly from the 1500 onwards, pretty much after the Renaissance, and who had this extraordinary bond with angels and knew how to work with them in ways which really isn't known even today. They were a very select group of people. They were not necessarily a secret society, and in fact, they didn't themselves refer to it as a secret society. They just felt that they were initiated. They knew about how to work with angels in various ways. Not everybody was identical. And you see throughout history how certain people like Eugène Delacroix, Nicolas Poussin, Anatole France, Maurice Barrès, George Sand, all of these people knew certain things about angels and worked it into their material, which was either a piece of art, in the sense of a painting. And specifically on the French side, books. Now, people who work facts into fiction, Kathleen, that's kind of like, must be a novel concept for you.
Yeah, funny. All right, I want to ask you some questions about Sans-Sulpice, because I have been in there many, many times. I have been in there with you. I think probably a lot of our listeners have either been there or certainly know of it, if not from the Da Vinci Code, then from other studies. Fascinating place, one of the most interesting churches in the world, all kinds of mysteries. And I think the mysteries are really far beyond the ones that were explored in the Da Vinci Code. I mean, one of my favorite pieces of art in the world actually is in that church, and it is the marble Italian Pietà, which shows Jesus and Mary Magdalene hand in hand, Jesus draped across his mother's lap, and his mother with her arms around both of them. It's an extraordinary piece of art. It's heartbreaking. It's beautiful. It is clearly a family portrait. There's some extraordinary things going on in Sans-Sulpice. And let's try to get some of this artwork up. So if you go to thespiritrevolution.com, we'll get some of this art up so you can take a look at it. I've got some great pictures of this Pietà, and I think we've got some pretty good pictures of these Delacroix paintings. The Delacroix paintings in Sans-Sulpice are phenomenal. They are fierce. You want to talk about someone who understood infusion. Delacroix knew what he was doing. In The Poet Prince, one of the things I talk about at length is that these extraordinary artists of the Renaissance, specifically Botticelli and Michelangelo, there were others. No, Leonardo was not one of them, so forget about him for a minute because he was not part of this club. But the great masters Botticelli and Michelangelo, certainly Donatello in his sculpture, Filippo Lippi, who was Botticelli's teacher, they all understood and practiced this extraordinary concept of infusion. And this idea of infusion is that these artists were doing far more than applying paint to canvas. This was not about painting. This was about being able to create art that was alive, art that had essence. It was about pouring your heart and your soul and your spirit, but most of all, a divine message and intention into the artwork. And that was what these extraordinary artists in the Renaissance were doing. And then that was a technique that was passed down through these artistic societies, and of which Delacroix was clearly an initiate, because when you stand in this chapel in Sans-Sulpice, you feel it. You feel the power of these angels, and it's fierce. I mean, that's the word that keeps coming back to me. I mean, when I'm in there, I feel the strength of this art, and I feel the power, particularly the angels who are protecting the treasure of Solomon. That's an amazing piece. And so I want to ask you a couple things. I want you to talk a little bit more about that. I've got some questions on, you know, what do you think that really meant? What were they saying with that painting in that chapel? But really my question is, what were they doing in this chapel? What was going on in this specific chapel in Sans-Sulpice? Who was behind putting it there, and what was happening in that space?
Well, who was behind it is a very difficult question to answer. It's definitely known that Delacroix did it as his mission. He made sure he got the commission. He began on the day of the Feast of the Angels. He made sure that, you know, he was there. It's also, when you read between the lines of certain people who saw him at work there, it was clear, as you were saying, that, you know, he was not only painting with infusion, but he was almost channeling. He was in this other zone. He was obsessed with doing it. And I think part of the reason was that that he realized that these people, this angelic society, which was, you know, not a secret society as such, needed a place to come to. And really the only explanation as to why Sans-Sulpice and the Chapel of Angels is so important comes back from fiction works of people who point out the importance of this chapel. And I think it's really Delacroix who made it important, if that makes sense. Before, it really, you know, it always was a Chapel of Angels, but many churches have chapels dedicated to angels. This stands out because I think in Paris, all of these people began to realize that really they needed to have something where they could meet and could hang out, and where other people could come to and experience what they had experienced. And I think what was really going on is this. Jean Cocteau is another person. Jean Cocteau is alleged Grand Master of the Priory of Zion, a person who definitely painted with infusion. But what is very little known about Jean Cocteau is that he was obsessed with angels. And you need to look at two specific of movies of him. One of them is Orpheus, and the other one is Testament of Orpheus. And whereas Orpheus is a very big movie, and pretty much made his name even bigger than it was already. And Testament of Orpheus was basically the sequel. In Hollywood days, it was made with the money of Orpheus, and he basically had free reign because he knew people would come and see it. And he goes overboard. He decides to incorporate into Testament of Orpheus so much autobiographical information that people will get it. And what he imparts is something which has happened to him about, I think, 20 to 25 years before he made Orpheus. And the story is this. Jean Cocteau was a very important, very enigmatic person who was already, way ahead of everybody else. He was an initiate. But at one point along his line of initiation, he sits in an elevator, or he stands in an elevator, and he hears a voice say, "That is my name." And he doesn't realize what's going on, and he begins to talk to this disembodied voice, and the only name he can see is the name of the elevator, which is Hurtubise. And the angel makes it clear that he is his guardian angel, and he says, "My name is Hurtubise." And Cocteau says, my life until that moment in time was a roller coaster ride already, but I had not expected anything whatsoever until that moment in time. And to make an extremely long story relatively short, what happened was this. Jean Cocteau realized that everything in his life and everything he'd been doing was initiation for his guardian angel to appear to him and say, "Look, man, you are at a crossroads. You can commit yourself completely and become one of our instruments on earth. We will guide you through your life. We will give you missions, but these will be missions of God given via us, and you will see that we do them for the betterment of mankind. And while you're doing this, we will take care of you because you're one of them, or one of us rather." And this becomes apparent in Testament of Orpheus, where there's a wonderful scene whereby Cocteau is dead, but at the same time alive. And people kind of like don't really recognize him. And there's one scene whereby the dead Cocteau is there, and the still alive Cocteau is walking around with his angel and sees his own dead body. And he says something along the lines of, "Oh, my poor dead body is there." And the angel says, "Well, you never really were one of them, were you?" And it is such a powerful moment of Cocteau realizing that actually he is this creature in between worlds. And that is very much the theme of the angelic society. At the core, it's people who, through whatever means, throughout whatever means, at whatever moment in time, have had this phenomenal encounter and decided to commit their entire life into doing this. And I think what the Chapel of the Angels and Saints Who Peace was actually all about was for one of them, i.e. Delacroix, to create a space which would be visited by relatively many people, whereby they would have that power and they might have those kind of experiences. And I think, if anything, the story of Baron Gessonnier going to Paris, which is like slapped all over the Priory of Zion because he had to have these codes and all of that, I think, if anything, Sonnier actually went there because of the Chapel of Angels, because there's lots of material in Sonnier, which says, first of all, that he went to Lyon, hung out with these people who knew all about angels, and specifically in his garden, there's lots of clues to angelic society in there as well. So I think that is very long answered to kind of say, what is the Chapel of Angels all about? I think it's to offer to your Joe Blog in the street who's walking around to Paris the possibility of being exposed to this and then see what happens. It's the first step of initiation into angelic society.
Well, it definitely has a sense of being a temple space. And it's funny because it is this sort of small chapel space right as you enter Saint-Sulpice. And Saint-Sulpice is enormous and beautiful. But there's an intimacy to this chapel. It definitely has an energy and an air about it that is completely different than the rest of the church. So it does feel like an initiation chamber of sorts. I'm really fascinated by that. I'm also really interested in the difference between what the Angelic Society was doing in France versus what the Order of the Holy Sepulchre was doing in Italy, because I think that they are connected. I think that in a lot of cases it's a name game. You know, these societies all have different names, but I think that they are all connected. They all come from the same line. They all come from the same type of thinking. So I think that was happening there. One of my questions for you is, because I'm trying to get some clarity on the differences and the similarities, what I love about what you just explained is, you know, I love the Cocteau story and Cocteau being visited by, you know, these angels and being given a mission, because that's really the essence of the Renaissance belief system too, is that the angels were there to aid those who were devoted to the mission. And I think that that's where we kind of go a little bit astray in our more new agey 20th to 21st century angel lore, is that we start to say, well, angels are there for us to find us parking spaces and, you know, to, you know, do whatever. I'm going to ask my angels to do all these things for me. And this whole concept of angels being in service, they are there to help us. Well, I absolutely believe that is true. And I've certainly seen it dramatically in my own life very recently, as a matter of fact. But I think that there are caveats. I don't think that angels are just kind of hanging out in spirit world saying, I'm going to find you a parking space if you need one. I think that there is a very, very specific commitment. There are powerful forces that are there to protect and to help people who make a commitment to a higher mission. And that's the essence of the Renaissance.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, in angelology, it's like, you know, the basic premise is, if you ask an angel to do something, he is bound to listen and normally do it for you. But I also think there's like an implied thing, which is, to stick with the example of parking space, it's something we can do. It's the angels are there to help us for the larger things. And I think this is kind of like the mission statement for us as well. It's like, you need to use them for real things. It's almost like, and I'm not being literal here. It's more like a little joke, like, you know, when you do die, that they present the invoice, and you really want to look at the fact that the angelic billing is for really powerful services, and that you do not get presented with, like, you know, okay, the angels took, you know, you took 1,000 hours of angelic time up on parking space. But that kind of, you know, you use them well and for the important moments in your life. And that is like the message of the angelic society, that they really were masters at this and at manipulating this as well. And I think that is really kind of like, you know, the really most important thing. And one of the things I want to get back to, because it ties all of this together, and it's a very important person, Joan of Arc. All of these people, Maurice Barrès specifically, all of these people who were into angels in France roughly from 1850 onwards were so much into Joan of Arc, we can't even go in there because it would be an entire show. Maurice Barrès, who I keep mentioning because he's so important, actually was one of those people who made sure that she got her own public holiday. And she is obviously at the beginning of the Poet Prince, and she's very important because she's the one whose mission is guided by angels. She's the one who basically educates leaders of France and saying, okay, you're fighting, but I can give you an advantage because I am, for better word, channeling in communication with quite important angelic beings, including Michael, and they are telling me to do and tell you to do certain stuff, which might not make any sense whatsoever, but if you trust in me and if you trust in them and if you commit yourself to them, everything will be fine.
Well, and it turned out to be not only the truth for a while, and I guess that's always been one of my questions with Joan. You know, Joan shows up in every single one of my books. I always mention her. I write about her. I am a huge Joan aficionado. I have been studying her since I was really a child. I ended up doing a report on George Bernard Shaw's St. Joan when I was, I think, in junior high school, and I was a goner ever since then. You know, Joni has had me in her thrall ever since. And I think that one of the reasons I write about her in every single one of my books is because on some level I know that I want to write a complete book about her. But every time I think about it, I'm so overwhelmed by what a huge undertaking it is. It's such, her subject matter is so big and so complex. For a girl who lived only to be 19 years old, what she accomplished and was involved in and what she touched is so extraordinary. And I think that's one of the reasons that she lives on in our consciousness for such a long time. But certainly she was all about angelic intervention. Now, one of the things that I also find interesting is in the Renaissance, on the Italian side, in the research that I have done, I do not find indications that they had specific guardian angels. I have not ever found any references to the belief in the order point of view that you had specific designated angels and that particular angel was your angel and this is what they did. Other than the archangelic characters. The archangelic characters can be invoked for very, very big missions. You know, when you want to bring in the heavy artillery, that's when you go after Michael. And we're going to get into Michael specifically because he really is, you know, the great king of the angels here. But it seems to me that given the Cocteau story and what the French Angelic Society is looking at, that maybe they did have a belief that we had designated angels. Like, this is your specific guardian angel for your life versus there's an army of angels out there and you can sort of tap into them when you need the help. What do you think?
I think what's happening there is that these people like Jean Cocteau, I think they might have had a more designated guardian angel than Joe Bloggs in the street. These people were there to do specific tasks and they had bought into specific purposes. And I think that's kind of like, they themselves don't make it that specific and they are not very clear about whether every single person has got an angelic being or not. But in the case of kind of what the angels are saying, they seem to be saying, yes, we are your guardian angel. Now, whether that's an exclusive one-on-one relationship or whether they had, 15,000 or a gazillion souls to look after, they don't really make that all that clear. But what it does suggest is that they had, it is a one-on-one relationship. You know, it's like a teacher with students. There might be 20 students in a classroom, but there's one teacher, and all of those students refer to that person as their teacher. And the following day when you walk in, you know that is still going to be your teacher. And I think that's definitely the way the French looked upon that relationship. But yes, a one-on-one relationship, I think, when you, again, and this is reading between the lines, I think when you become like a Joan of Arc character, then they kind of like, you know, they definitely make sure that they are kind of like not giving you the junior guardian angel, so to speak, but that you come into a slightly higher category. And you see that with other people as well, like Maurice Barrès, definitely Joan of Arc. You see that there is definitely a hierarchy of angels and that the more your mission becomes more important for God, the higher rapport you have in the army of God, which is like, you know, what angels would always refer to.
Well, in the Renaissance, we have multiple generations of important artists. Because really, prior to Lorenzo, his grandfather, Cosimo de' Medici, is the one who really gives birth to this idea of nurturing these Renaissance artists to be scribes for the teachings of this angelic information. In fact, he refers to his artists as his angelics, as a type of angelic army who are scribes of the divine. And they are trained to be that. They are nurtured to be that. And then his grandson, Lorenzo, is the one who takes this to the next level. So we see it with sculptors like Donatello, with the extraordinary Magdalene that he creates that is out of this world, emotional. We see it with Filippo Lippi, who creates what is, for my money, the most beautiful Madonnas ever, including Botticelli's, which I love. But Lippi's were transcendent in a very, very special way. But he then passed that information to his protege, who is Sandro Botticelli, and also his son, Filippino Lippi. But I think that Botticelli outpainted the younger Lippi. But they were very good friends, and they were all very committed, again, to expressing these angelic processes. But the next generation, we have a very, very special artist who, in, you know, my opinion, and we can, art historians can argue this for as long as they want, but I think is the greatest artist in human history, and that is Michelangelo Buonarroti. And I talk about this, I tell this story in The Poet Prince, and it was a real joy for me to tell this story because it's an aspect of Michelangelo, depending on how you want to pronounce it. It's an element of Michelangelo's story that you very, very rarely hear. You know, you kind of get the traditional art history stuff and, you know, where he was, you know, he was born into this sort of poor family and, you know, he ends up in Florence and, you know, the whole stonecutter's son kind of thing. But what most people don't understand is that the Buonarroti family was not a poor family. His father was a fairly important character. But beyond that, the Buonarroti family had incredibly powerful noble bloodlines. And they claimed to be descended from the great Matilda of Tuscany, who certainly people who are familiar with my work will know about Matilda, who is the heroine of my second book, The Book of Love, incredible woman who changed the world, one of the most powerful, extraordinary, inspirational women, who was Joan of Arc's model. Joan of Arc modeled herself after Matilda of Tuscany. So I've always found, you know, that pretty interesting because there was some extraordinary things going on with Matilda, who was also having visions of an angelic nature and otherwise. Well, Michelangelo's family claimed to be descended from Matilda, and what we know through our Renaissance studies, and again, I tell the story in The Poet Prince, is that Lorenzo and his grandfather were both using astrology, and they had enlisted the help of astrologers who were from a society that were actually descended from the original Magi from the Bible, and they were still called the Magi. The Medici had their own organization, the Confraternity of the Magi, that celebrated this and celebrated astrology. Lorenzo's primary teacher, Marsilio Ficino, was one of the greatest astrologers in history. So what was happening in the Renaissance is they were watching astrologically the birth of certain children from certain bloodlines. So when certain families were expecting a child, the Magi would be brought in to say, what are the stars saying about this child? If this child is born, you know, is this an auspicious time? And what happens with the Buonarroti family is the Magi say, hold it, this is a special child. The aspects of this child's chart are not normal. They are extraordinary. They are exalted. This child is angelic. And thus, he was given the name of the Archangel Michelangelo. Michael the Archangel. This was not common. Michelangelo was not a common name in the Renaissance. It's not a common name now, though there were certainly artists that were named after him afterwards, like Michelangelo Caravaggio. But Michelangelo was really, you know, one of the first to carry this name. And it was not a coincidence. It was not an accident. They didn't just, you know, lay this on this child. He was predicted by the Magi that he was going to have angelic talent, which is why by the age of 6, they had already identified that he had this extraordinary ability to create. And so he was nurtured, same way that Lorenzo was nurtured. You know, Lorenzo is the poet prince. Lorenzo's birth is not only announced, but essentially he is conceived as an angelic being, which goes into the whole concept of Immaculate Conception, how angels were invoked during specific conception, which is part of a, probably a bigger topic for another day. But again, it's something that I really cover in the Poet Prince, this idea of conception rituals that were happening in the Renaissance and certainly earlier, in which couples would invoke angelic beings while they were in their union. And the idea was to invite angelic beings into the body of the woman, so that when she was impregnated, this baby would come through as an angelic force. And thus, Michelangelo is born with the name of the archangel, and then goes on to be this extraordinary messenger of God. And one of the things that I find incredible about his story is when you study his life, which is very long, especially for his time, he lives to be to a very old age. For a lot of reasons, he shouldn't. So there is all kinds of protection around him. But Michelangelo was a very singular character. And this is one of the things that I find interesting. He did not have great relationships in his life. He was very solitary. He was very much a loner. But I think that was part of this angelic persona that he had. I think he was so committed to his mission to create that he would not allow anything else to intervene. And so I've often wondered, how literal are we supposed to be with this? Was he a version of the Archangel Michael coming to deliver the truth in his own way? Coming to slay evil by the bringing of beauty and light? You know, is it a metaphorical thing? Did he have angelic influence, or is it a lot more literal than that? I don't know, but I love his story. I think he's one of history's amazing characters, and I still think there's a lot about him and his art that has never been entirely understood.
And when you say kind of like, you know, the child was named Michelangelo, the importance of names is so important within all of this. It's stories about how you were able to manipulate in a positive way your angel if you knew his name. The trick about becoming like an adept, a real initiate of the angelic society had to do with finding out the name of your guardian angel, because that way, you know, you had the true rapport. Just imagine if you're praying and say, "Angel, help me." And I'm making slight fun of it here, but like the angels kind of go, "Okay, who do you want?" Kind of, you know. But if you knew, if you had access, if you had matured to kind of say, "Okay, my angel is this person," that being would be there for you. And naming is always very important. And I just want to take it on a slight sidetrack, which is that angels also make a very important appearance in the Grail literature, specifically with one person, Wolfram van Essenbach. And Wolfram, you know, forget about cups or V-shaped things. When we delve into Wolfram, Wolfram makes something very beautiful, and he says this. He says, when the angels fell, because he calls everybody, every soul an angel, he says, what was decided was that there would be a black stone which was going to be placed on earth. And that stone was a means for ascension for those who wanted to redeem themselves and wanted to return to God. And he says the neutral angels, those who did not enter the conflict between God and Lucifer, would make use of this stone to ascend and descend from heaven to earth and back and forth. And this black stone was called the Grail. And that is a very unique perspective. Now, when you see how he develops this, he says, well, it's a black stone, and those who were called upon the mission see their name appear on this stone. And those people who already are part of the mission, those who have accepted their destiny, the Grail Brotherhood, whatever you want to call them, they see the name of this future initiate written on this stone. And then it is basically their task to go out into the world and find this person. And I think it's very similar. I mean, you know, Wolfram wrote this roughly 1200. It's almost three centuries before the Florentine aspect of this is repeated, whereby you have a group of people who are part of an inner circle and watch out for people who they know they need to get almost from birth and guide them through maturity to become part of the mission. And once again, the importance of angels is there.
Can you talk a little bit about this concept of neutral angels? I'd never heard of it until I started, I read Servants of the Grail, and that's where I first discovered your all this amazing information you have about what Wolfram was actually saying. And Servants of the Grail is an amazing book, and everyone needs to read it. But this whole concept of a neutral angel is one that was really, really new to me. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what a neutral angel actually is and what they do.
Well, the neutral angels, very simple, is that, you know, when God said to Lucifer, yes, you can do whatever you want, God allowed the angels to basically make up their minds. And part of the ability to make up your mind is that you do not choose sides. And so when you did not choose sides, you basically ended up being the neutral angels. And they are very intriguing. They are, they don't seem to be, they're definitely not in league with Lucifer, because by that account they would have ended up,
being not neutral,
but also would not end up in heaven. And they also, are not really on Michael's side, because that means they would always be in heaven. So the neutral angels seem to have this ability to go back and forth. They can be here or down on Earth, what was generally regarded as the domain of chaos and the domain of Lucifer in the traditional point of view. But they also can go to heaven. And they seem to be something which a lot of Christianity doesn't really focus on that much. You find a bit more about them in the Sumerian traditions or the Egyptian traditions, where you find beings who, here we go again, are quite often misinterpreted as ancient aliens or ETs. These beings who seem to hover around Earth, but then sometimes seem to pop up on Earth, and then, they're gone again. And they are the ones who have been the Sumerian and Egyptian traditions are the ones who have focused a tiny bit more, I think, on these neutral angels. And I think part of the importance of the Grail legends is actually that they point out the fact that these entities are there. As to what they do, within an angelic context, very little attention has ever been paid to them. So it's a really hard question for me to answer.
Okay, because I'm not done with you yet. So if Michael is the king of the light angels and Lucifer is the king of the dark angels and the Grail is a black stone somewhere in the middle, who does the Grail serve?
That's a very interesting question, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's always the question is who does the Grail serve? But, I mean, this whole concept of the Grail being, this ascension tool that is in between these two things. I think we can do 500 hours on the Grail and what it is and all the different versions of it. And I think that maybe we should. But this whole concept that the Grail has this angelic association, I think, is something that people haven't really looked at. And that's the magic of this subject, is that it's everywhere. I mean, it really shows up in all of the great mythologies. It shows up in all of the great legends and folklore. I mean, even just the idea of knowing your guardian angel's name, therefore, gives you some kind of power and connection, certainly harkens back to the Egyptian legends, right? The goddess knows the name of Ra, and therefore she can control, his comings and goings. I mean, what about the Egyptians and angels? Where do the Egyptians stand on angels?
Well, I mean, obviously, the traditional point of view is that, how are angels depicted? Beings, relatively human-looking, but let's give them wings. And that is so typical Egyptian it is Egyptian. It's how the Egyptians depicted their deities. The most telltale signs is probably the images you see on boxes, for example, from Tutankhamun's treasure, where you have a box and on each side you have a female angel sitting there with her wings all spread out, basically protecting the box, basically protecting the being inside.
But we look at that as the winged Isis, correct?
That is correct. But it is the way we are thinking of angels. And specifically, you know, what is the role of Isis? She's seen as this protectress, this person who protects people. This, you know, Sekhmet is not depicted as such with little angels. Yet, when you look at the angelic society, this fierce Sekhmet quality, you know, Michael is not depicted with a fluffy toy.
No, no, Michael is depicted, you know, skewering the devil. Michael is depicted, you know, in hand-to-hand bloody combat. You know, Michael is slaying. Michael kicks butt. He is not gentle.
Jacob is struggling with, you know, his guardian angel. That is not some kind of, like, you know, philosophical debate. These men, the way Delacroix depicts them, are hand-to-hand. You know, Heliodorus being chased from the temple. This is brutal. Michael, you know, telling what Joe needs to do. We know that Michael didn't say, okay, you know, maybe you should talk to these English people. No, Michael kind of says, okay, you need, I mean, Michael isn't saying it necessarily just only to Joan. I think he's making out a point that for certain things to happen, you need to be hard. You need to be able to wipe out these beings or these people. And that's very much Sekhmet as well. It's kind of like, you know, diplomacy isn't always the nice way. And what you always say is, I will not be quiet.
No, absolutely not. The truth against the world, right? But, you know, that's the thing. You know, Sekhmet is the eater of souls. She is fierce, and she is often depicted as negative. But when you really dig into Sekhmet's legends, there's nothing negative about her. She is an avenging angel. She is, you know, a Michael type of character. She is righteous. And so, yeah, she'll devour your soul, but only if you're evil. You know, she's the cleanup queen. And so in her way, even though it's depicted differently, it's really the same energy, isn't it, as Michael. And we see this over and over again. We see it in Legends of the Saints. We see certain saints in their legends really become the embodiment of the same energy on earth. Certainly for men, Saint George slaying the dragon. It's easy when you're running around Europe like we are, looking at all this artwork. The Saint Michaels and the Saint Georges tend to kind of blend into each other, and you can usually only tell the difference because Saint George has no wings. But other than that, their depictions are almost identical. So Saint George is really the embodiment of Saint Michael on Earth. He is slaying the dragons. He is eliminating the darkness. He is, you know, a crusader for the light. He is serving the mission. And, of course, I love the St. George legend, and you find the St. George legend very, very prominently in the more heretical parts of Europe. Matilda had a church dedicated to St. George, because in St. George's legend, what is he doing? He is rescuing the princess. He is rescuing the enslaved and entrapped princess. And it's all allegory. It's all allegory for, you know, the release of the divine feminine energies. And that's what George is doing in his legend. So you certainly see him show up as the embodiment of Michael on Earth. But there are also female Michaels, aren't there? There are a number of female embodiments of Michael on Earth that we find in the hagiography of these saints, specifically Saint Margaret of Antioch, who is one of my favorites, and, you know, just an incredible character. And you see her with the dragon. You don't see the women usually as in battle, although periodically you will see Margaret with a sword or with a spear or in some way slaying the dragon. But also the other character is Saint Martha. Saint Martha is all over the south of France. There are all kinds of churches dedicated to her there. Her relics are there. Certainly she came to the south of France with Mary Magdalene, where she was responsible for the taming of the Tarasca, which is essentially the water version of the dragon who lived in the river. But again, the same story. Now, what I love about Martha's version of the story is Martha actually doesn't slay the dragon. Martha tames the Tarasca. She tames the animal. She treats it with love and compassion and understanding, and actually tames it, as opposed to these other characters who are more about slaying. So her, I find her story incredibly interesting because it's a fierce compassion as opposed to a fierce warrior energy, but it's all related.
Yes, and this aspect of both control and slaying is something which I always feel that one of the most beautiful things which have ever been done, but are very less known, is this story between what happens at the, I keep forgetting to correct it, but roughly during the papacy of Pope Leo XIII, which is at the end of the 19th century. He has celebrated Mass, and after Mass he just collapses. And people fear the worst. They fear he is dead, he's apoplectic, and then he gets up, and people are worried. And he says, I have just heard a conversation between God and Lucifer. And people think, oh my God, okay, he's lost it, even though he's Pope. And they realize that he's actually making sense. And what he's saying is that between this deal and this battle which is ensuing in the heavens between God and Lucifer, Lucifer is asking for more time. Because he says, if you give me a bit more time, then, you know, I'll be able to win this battle. And God kind of goes, okay, that's fine by me. And what Pope Leo XIII does is he creates a very special prayer to Michael. And he instructs the entire Catholic Church to say this prayer to Michael at each service. And it was in place until the Second Vatican Council in 1963, when it was removed. But basically, this aspect, this prayer to Saint Michael, says, first of all, you know, Michael, help us so that evil is controlled. Then, Michael, it's up to you to devour the souls of these evil beings. So it's this twin aspect of like the two aspects of control and basically suppressing it. And it's you know, when you look at that specific aspect, it's also very Egyptian. It's the Maat principle of order and balance, and basically the unjust will be judged upon death, and their souls will be eaten, their souls will be devoured. And when you read Pope Leo XIII's prayer to Michael, that is very much prominent in there. It's kind of like saying, help us do this, help us fill your mission. And it's actually one of the, you know, as bizarre as it is, and as corrupt and as bizarre as the Catholic Church is, I think this prayer and this episode of what happened to Leo XIII is actually very interesting and very mature, and what he did with the prayer is actually very deep, and it's also very unknown and very unappreciated.
So as we're getting ready to wrap up here, is this whole thing, this whole existence that we were a part of, really just a battle between the angels?
I always think that even when you look at the other examples of like what is this universe kind of, and you give it, you surrender it to the quantum physicists. When you listen to people who have had near-death experiences, stories about reincarnation, basically what they seem to be suggesting is that we wanted to experience life on Earth, and that certain people just want to experience it and do not very much apart from laying in the sun and say, okay, that's all we want, and that they will go to extreme lengths to just lay in the sun. But that just means that you stay here on Earth and you will lay in the sun for a gazillion years. And that there is another aspect which actually says, okay, you have laid in the sun now for a gazillion years. Maybe you should get over it. You should get over yourself and you should get back to God. And that, I think, is basically when you read an Amit Goswami on the self-aware universe, which combines, you know, middle Hindu Buddhist mythology, and when you read all of, you know, his quantum physicists, because Amit is one of the most renowned quantum physicists there are, you know, you find a very consistent imagery. And I think it's quite often just that over time people use different wording and kind of, you know, whether you approach this from one perspective with a certain vocabulary or from another, I think the end conclusion to the answer is, if you want to have it in one word, yes. But I don't think it's as simple as that.
Well, for all of our listeners who are Lost fans, I was really hoping that J.J. Abrams and his crew would take this approach, and that the island represented a piece of this battle between the angels. And certainly with Jacob's Ladder and that kind of thing, I really thought they were going there. But alas, I gave them too much credit, and instead they did something that was, you know, so much less interesting and less meaningful. Sorry, that's my opinion. Lost really disappointed me this year, so I just had to get that in there. But I do think that, you know, this whole concept of us being in the middle of the Battle of the Angels, and I want to just sort of bring this back. We always come back to Beringer, Saunière. We always come back to Rennes Le Château because it's our spiritual heartland, and we love it. Was this what he was referencing when he said this place is terrible?
Yes. There is actually no maybe there, because it's a specific quote from where Jacob is sleeping on the stone, and he sees angels descending from earth to heaven, and vice versa. And you know, it's a stone. Oh my God, could it be like a Grail stone?
Do you think that the Grail stone was ever in Rennes Le Château?
Of course it wasn't. I think there is, you know, read Servants of the Grail for that one. I think the person who owned Rennes Le Château definitely knew more about it, and knew specifically that it was not so much a physical treasure, even though there's a physical component to it, but, you know, the classic message is about Heliodorus being chased from the temple. This is not about material wealth, this is all about spiritual wealth, and the message of the Grail and the message of angels is definitely that we need to move from material wealth to spiritual wealth, and that we need to experience life on earth not just from a material point of view, but from a spiritual point of view. And I think that's probably the key message of this game between God and Lucifer, that God is very happy with people living on earth and incarnating, but that it should have a purpose and it should be large, part of a larger plan, which is precisely what Wolfram writes in his mission statement as well, that, you know, we have been entrusted Earth to look after it as a very beautiful place. And that, I think, is basically the challenge which is ahead of us, and probably the central message of so many things which we need to realize in this day and age.
I think that is a beautiful way to end this edition of the Spirit Revolution. I do want to say, let's get up a link to your book, Servants of the Grail, because it's extraordinary. And certainly my readers who are fans of the Book of Love will, if you read Servants of the Grail, you will see where the work that Philip and I have been doing for so many years, even long before we met, was really intersecting. There are elements of Servants of the Grail that you could just intersperse into the Book of Love and vice versa. But Servants of the Grail has such extraordinary research. It's the most unique, innovative book on the Grail in a really long time, so I want to get that up there on the website. So we will do that. Take a look at us at thespiritrevolution.com. And for this week, I'm Kathleen McGowan.
I'm Philip Cobham.
The Truth Against the World.